Meet Mrs. McSugal. Her memoir bears no resemblance whatsoever to real life. It is 100% fiction and fabrication, or, to put it bluntly, complete codswallop. Indeed, none of the public figures named will recognise one grain of truth in her farcical fibs and fantasies. This satirical monologue does not represent the views or actions of any person, living or dead.
Mrs. McSugal, Scotland's second finest actress.
You couldn't make it up, but she just did. Episode 1, A Star is Born.
Who would be an actress these days? No one is working. They just sit by the telephone all day eating donuts, or worse, doing online yoga. I count my blessings to have found fame and fortune in the golden age of Hollywood, 1975 or thereabouts, when a star was still a star, as Bob the Street Cat used to say. I was what they call a child prodigy, belting out Puccini's O Mio Babbino Caro while sitting on my potty. You should have heard the cheers when I took my bows, though Mummy told me later they were actually because Partick Thistle had just scored. It was Mummy who first spotted the star quality in her only child, or the poor man's Bonnie Langford, as she preferred to call me. You see, Mummy had some experience of the business, having danced at Carnegie Hall in Dunfermline, and could have been the next Judy Garland if Liza Minnelli hadn't had an unfair advantage. "What's the point in being nouveau riche if we don't exploit the girl?" she used to shout at poor Daddy when he pleaded with her just to let me enjoy my childhood. Every day after playgroup, she would march me to the highly regarded Monica Glenn School of Drama and Car Maintenance for my Theatres of Modernity class. And it wasn't long before I made my stage debut in their Christmas production, Mary and Joseph Put a Ring on It. I played the innkeeper's wife, such a complex character for one so young. How could a wifey who works in the service industry heartlessly turn away a heavily pregnant woman? And just before Christmas? The strain of playing such a wretched creature got to me in the end, and I had the most dreadful stage fright on opening night, bulking up last night's kebab all down my costume. My understudy managed to sponge most of it off in the wings, but you should have heard the gagging from the front row when I entered stage left. Still, my hard work paid off when I received a rave review from Kate Adie, of all people, in Scaffolders Monthly. "Kiki Jean is a mere 4 years old," she wrote, "but she is utterly perfect in the role of this prize bitch. So real was her performance, one wonders if she was acting at all." Cheeky besom. I'll give her a war zone if I ever run into her. Our local minister, Reverend Toby Sparkle, was much more supportive. He came to see me in the WI production of Equus, and he begged me afterwards to join St. Lolita's church choir. I tried to explain that hymns don't move me in the same way as, say, Cotton Eye Joe, but he won me over when he said the next choral concert would be a selection of works by Mark Almond. It turned out Toby Sparkle was a very progressive young minister, with his "O Bondage Up Yours" t-shirt and penis piercings. As a teen, I always wanted a tattoo exactly like his, but thank God I dodged that bullet. Who needs a naked Terry Wogan straddling a motorbike on a forearm in 2024? Mummy used to say, "Your nice young minister is something of a pin-up with the old dears at McCarthy and Stone." She tried to tell them they were barking up the wrong tree, but they just didn't get tainted love, bless them. It was my beloved cousin, Bobbly Sue, who accompanied me to London to follow my dream of becoming a professional actress. On our first night in the big city, she said, "Let's go and see some real theatre," as opposed to the Strathbogie rep variety. We must have spent hours poring over the reviews. There were comedies, tragedies, musicals, even Shakespeare, who never really caught on north of the border, but we finally chose something called The Chippendales. I was so thankful we did, when the following day at my audition for drama school, Prunella Scales asked me to give a critique of the last play I'd seen. Talk about a gift! I must have blethered on for hours about each character. The cop, the cowboy and the Roman emperor, played by someone called Magic Malcolm in a dental floss thong. Prunella said it sounded marvellous, and she and Timothy simply must go, and then invited me to give my audition speech. "And can I be frank?" she said. "I'm buggered if I'll sit through one more Wherefore Art Thou. Surprise me, Kiki Jean Mankini, surprise me." "Well, I think you're going to like this," I said as I whipped off my bra and put in my false teeth. "For tonight, Prue, I am going to be Sybil Fawlty." "Oh, I know." There I was, waiting for her to say, "Darling, you're even better at me than I am." But it was all a bit awkward as I got nothing. Zippo. I still don't know how I got through my speech. The moving scene when Sybil opens up to some passing Lothario about her mother's morbid fears. But even when I'd finished, she just sat there staring at me as if she was in shock or something. I heard later she wanted to sue. But when Buzz Aldrin turned down their offer and went to Radha instead, she was overruled. And 6 weeks later, there I was, standing on the steps of the prestigious Peggy Mountview Theatre School. I always said the wrong Peggy got the damehood. Ashcroft was fine in the right role, but she could never have carried a sitcom. Peggy Mount was an inspiration and helped to keep her young protege's feet on the ground. "You there in the tiara," she would shout at me. "Don't come crying to me when you're just another out-of-work actor on a park bench pretending to read Beckett." But she meant it in a caring way. I was the next big thing in the eyes and ears of our singing teacher, Pierce Brosnan, who trained us only to use the notes la, ti, do. "Ignore the rest," he said. "I always do. It'll save on warm-up time, and it's all you'll ever need for take that look off your face. And using the others is simply vulgar and attention-seeking." But it was our esteemed patron, Larry Olivier, who shared with us the secret of becoming a truly great actor. "Try not to talk over the other actors, darlings," he would say. "Let them finish their lines before you start yours." Well, talk about genius. You could have heard a pin drop. After that, I always tried to let my fellow actors get their sentences out first. Although it was more of a life sentence waiting for Geraldine McEwan to finally finish emoting. I once polished off a whole packet of cheesy watsits waiting for her to get through Lady Macbeth's hands that do dishes speech. Next thing, the director's shouting, "Cut!" I whispered to Jerry, "You'd be good in Crossroads." Then I had it out with him. "Is there a problem, Mr. Tarantino?" "The problem is," he said, "a lady in waiting would not be munching on prepackaged savoury snacks in Elizabethan times." "What, not even Pringles?" I protested. But he'd already flounced off. I'm sure that can't be right. I'd spent a good half hour in Les Mahago Library researching my role as serving wench, open bracket brunette, close bracket, and not one historian mentioned a shortage of crisps. It was such an honour when our period movement tutors voted me the student most likely to appear in Heidi High. But it didn't half unleash the jealous rage of my fellow drama students. Even my lovely Scottish accent was fair game. "Try that again in English," they would say. "We didn't understand a word of it." "Well, Jings Crivens, help my bob," I told them. "I'm fair scun it with yish bunch of sleekit, cowering, timorous beasties. Look at all the outstanding actors Scotland has given to the world over the years. There's me, Ronnie Corbett, wasn't he wonderful in Nuns on the Run? James Naughty, Marlena Dietrich, of course, and Audrey and Catherine Hepburn's sister, the footballer, you know, the one with the home perm. Dee Hepburn, that's her. And, oh, too many to mention." One never forgets one's first appearance in the West End. I was playing a young Cleo Lane in the Shabba-doodly-wee-wee affair. And on opening night, I looked up at the poster outside the Gaiety and finally found my name, 13 below Moira Stewart. Gee! Hey, Mankini, you've only gone and made it, I screamed, scaring the living daylights out of some passing Japanese tourists. And I felt that same buzz of excitement every performance during the entire run. They truly were 2.5 of the best weeks of my life. But as one door closed, another opened when I was cast opposite Ralph Richardson, Celia Johnson and Margaret Leighton in Ken Russell's classic thriller Skinny Dipping. Not one, but three icons of British cinema. Sadly, I didn't actually meet any of them as I was only on set for one day, but my role as Skinny Dipping Water Polo Girl number 4 was integral to the plot. Then something devastating happened. The director cut my scene completely. He must have had some kind of breakdown, there's no other explanation, but it was a cruel blow nonetheless. I'd told everyone about me and my pals Celia, Ralph and Margaret, and it was too late now. Mummy and Daddy had booked the sleeper train for Ecclefechan for the premiere, and I wasn't even in the bloody thing. Thank God the producers were very kind. And on the night, me and the other axed water polo girlies were allowed up on stage to join the cast. The only thing was they made us stand in the third row, so no one in the audience could see us. I put up with it for a few minutes, then I tapped Denholm Elliot on the shoulder and I promised to sort out his dandruff if he'd budge up a bit. I managed to squeeze in between him and Linda Bellingham, and I could see the audience a lot better from there. I felt for the three stars in the front row, though. They looked so lonely out there on their own. So I took one more step forward, and I found myself between Celia Johnson and Margaret Leighton. Truth be told, they looked a bit nonplussed to see me, but instinct took over and I grabbed their hands, shouted, "We love you all!" to the audience and took a bow. Well, before you could say, "Move over, darling," the audience rose to their feet and Celia, Margaret and Ralph found themselves bobbing up and down with me. I must have bowed 7 times as the adrenaline just kept pumping. I dreamt of this moment and I never wanted it to end. Thankfully, Celia spotted that poor old Ralphie was on the verge of collapse, so she let go of his hand and some kind soul brought him a chair and we three iconic actresses just kept on going. I could hear Margaret shouting in my ear, cut it out, you bitch," as I bowed over and over, but I shouted back, "Feel the love, Maggie, feel the love!" My parents were beaming with pride, but they were a tad puzzled after the film had finished. "Were you actually in it?" Mummy asked. "You didn't see me?" I said, "No," Daddy said. "We kept thinking you must be in the next scene, but you never were." "Oh, you missed me," I assured him. "I was the one who looked like Linda Bellingham." "But I thought that was Linda Bellingham," Mummy said. "No, that was me done up to look like her," I said. "It's called acting." I wasn't sure if they'd buy it, but I needn't have worried. They'd have believed I was Ralph Richardson, they were so proud. "You're an even better actress than we thought," they said, which was so beautiful to hear. It was just a shame that once Celia and Margaret pulled me off to the side of the stage, a couple of security guards ushered me out through a different exit to the rest of the cast. We never did manage to find a way into the after-show party, but we hung around outside to say goodnight. Mummy heard Celia muttering something under her breath about that Z-list psycho as she hurried past. She must have been referring to Margaret Leighton. You can guess who was splashed all over the front pages in the morning. "Stars fury as deranged Scottish extra storm stage," screamed the headlines. I needed a whole new scrapbook for my press cuttings. But you can imagine my potty mouth when I saw myself described as an extra. My darling agent, Champion Soames of Cast Off Casting, was very reassuring, however, and said the phone had been ringing off the hook all day. It was very gratifying, I must say, and we sat down together and sifted through the offers. In the end, we ruled out the Shopping Channel, which left us with an impossible decision: a juicy run on Broadway or the lead in a movie. The movie was a low-budget affair called Totally Hot Stuff, being filmed by a group of randy students at the Anglia Ruskin University Halls of Residence. All good so far, but Champion had real concerns about the film's finances. How would he get his 15% if the boys had already spent their student loans? And I had to bring my own sandwiches. No, the road ahead was clear. Kiki Jean Mankini was on her way to Broadway. Well, off-Broadway, truth to tell. So far off-Broadway, it's in Connecticut, Jane Fonda said. But what an honour to play opposite Dame Maggie Smith in a Hispanic production of Trafford Tansy. An honour and a great responsibility on my slender shoulders. By the time my Aeroflot flight touched down at JFK, I was cacking myself, I don't mind telling you. So it was such a nice surprise to arrive at my digs and find I was sharing with my old friends, the Crankies. They were in town working as Grace Jones backing dancers. And after their show, wee Jamie would grab his hula hoop and we would hot trot it down to Studio 54 and hang out with anyone who was anyone in NYC. Warren Beatty, Salvador Dali, Esther Ranson, they just couldn't get enough of the wee lasses in their tartan pinafores. 1 minute, Andy Warhol and I were giving it loudly to Oops Upside Your Head. And the next, lovely old Carrie Fisher was twirling wee Jimmy round and round the dance floor, shrouded in veils and high as a kite, wailing, "Pigs in space, pigs in space." Bianca Jagger said it was the funniest thing she'd ever seen. "And you've seen Mick naked?" I said. Oh, we laughed. Yet, behind all the glitz and the glamour, no one could have predicted the heartbreak of my play being taken off after opening night, or during the interval of opening night, as the New York Times enjoyed putting in capitals on their front page. The reviews were so offensive that I demanded retractions, but Dame Maggie just wanted to get home to her budgies. "This wrestling malarkey isn't for me, darling," she said. "From now on, I'll stick to Pilates." At our first night-come rap party, I tried to get her to open up to me, but she couldn't do it. "I'm sorry, Kira Jane," she said. "Magnificent Maggie is a maudlin Maggie tonight. Even National Treasures need a night off occasionally." I felt myself welling up, and wee Jimmy was in pieces. So we plonked her next to Ollie Murs and said we really must pop to the powder room. And that's when it happened. There I was, sitting on the loo, thinking, if it doesn't happen tonight, it never will. When who knocks on the door but Richard Burton? I invited him in for a nightcap, but you can imagine my surprise when he knelt down, looked at me with those bewitching grey-green eyes of his and slurred,
"Dolores, Dolores."
"But I'm Kiki Jean," I said, a mite confused. "Kiki Jean Mankini, charmed, I'm sure." But it was to no avail.
"Dolores," he burped. "I must talk to you, man to woman, great actor to you. It's a tough business out there, but don't let them break you. You are delicious, darling. Delicious. Never forget it."
And I haven't. In fact, I often sit here and wonder what might have been if Liz Taylor hadn't tapped on the door and asked to borrow some bog roll. Not the first thing you expect to come out of Cleopatra's mouth. But no one likes to be caught short.
Mrs. McSugal, Scotland's second finest actress, starred Carolyn Pickles. It was written by Jonathan Fortingall. Sound by Norman Goodman. Song title is Funky Disco by Biz Baz Studio. It was directed by Colin Wakefield and produced by Yellow Brick Grove in association with Double Honours Productions. Book available on Amazon. Mrs. McSugal is dedicated to Hannah Gordon, a truly fine Scottish actress.